Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In this week's show, we'll be looking at the history of food in America, ethnic food to be more specific, with Hassia Diner, author of Hungering for America, Italian, Irish, and Jewish Foodways in the Age of Migration. We'll also be looking back at 9/11 again, this time to 9/11/02, or the first anniversary of the tragic event of 2001 and how we chose to commemorate it. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on October 22, 1962, in a televised speech, President John F. Kennedy announced that U.S. spy planes had discovered Soviet missile bases in Cuba. The missile sites, under construction but nearing completion, housed medium-range missiles capable of striking a number of major cities in the United States. Kennedy announced that he was ordering a naval quarantine of Cuba to prevent Soviet ships from transporting any more offensive weapons to the island, and explained that the U.S. would not tolerate the existence of the missile sites currently in place. The president made it clear that America would not stop short of military action to end what he called a clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace. The quarantine began on October 23rd, and the next day approaching Soviet ships altered or reversed their course, with the exception of one ship that was allowed to proceed after the U.S. determined it posed no threat. On October 26, the Soviets proposed to remove their missile sites in exchange for a U.S. pledge not to invade Cuba and to remove its missiles in Turkey. Kennedy agreed, and the Cuban Missile Crisis ended peacefully.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, both relating to Cuba, according to recently declassified documents, the Kennedy administration, seeking a pretext to invade Cuba, contemplated blowing up a U.S. Navy ship in Guantanamo Bay, faking casualties and blaming it on Fidel Castro. In a March 1962 memo, written several months before the Cuban Missile Crisis, an anonymous Pentagon official outlined a series of well-coordinated incidents to take place in and around Guantanamo with the appearance of being done by hostile Cuban forces. A March 13th letter to Defense Secretary Robert McNamara reports that the Joint Chiefs of Staff studied the document and recommended that it be forwarded as, quote, a preliminary submission suitable for planning purposes. The memo was written at the behest of Senior Joint Chiefs official, Brigadier General William Craig, who was involved in planning Operation Mongoose, the ill-fated attempt to topple the Castro regime through sabotage and disruption. And the University of Florida libraries are poised to undertake their own operation in Cuba to preserve three centuries of handwritten history deteriorating in that country's national archives. At stake are the notary protocols, 10 million handwritten pages that tell the story of colonial Spain through the records of births and deaths, wills and marriages, property deeds, and ships' manifests. I'm convinced that the protocols will assume their rightful place of global importance for New World history, said John Ingram, project director. These records will truly open a window in time. This is Talking History.
Black Market Bay. Baby, no place to play.
back. Talking History's Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University, sat down recently with Hasia Diner to discuss her new book on food in America, and in particular the cuisines of three immigrant groups, Italians, Irish, and Jews. Here's what they had to say.
What's for dinner? That's our subject today, particularly the answers to that question, what's for dinner, in the immigrant families of America. We'll consider the fascinating connections between immigration and food, the rich textures of our American notions of ethnic food. My guest today is Hasia Diner, who is the Paul and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at New York University and the author of a new book, Hungering for America, Italian, Irish, and Jewish Foodways in the Age of Migration. Welcome to our show, Professor Diner.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you initially here, why you decided to write a book about food. Is this a subject that's really to be taken seriously?
I think food is extremely serious. One could say that it is the most clear index or window into a particular culture. A 18th century French philosopher once wrote, "Tell me what you eat and I will tell you what you are." And we say that in American English as "you are what you eat," and there's a great deal to that.
Yes. You focus in Hungering for America, your new book, on three particular immigrant groups, Irish, Italian, Eastern European Jews. But let's start at the most general level before we move to those three groups. Is there a common experience of food for all or most all immigrants to America?
That class of people who emigrated to the United States, doesn't really matter where they came from, tended to represent a particular class of the place they left. The very wealthiest rarely had any reason to leave, okay? Mm-hmm. Because life was quite fine for them. And the very poorest usually couldn't. So that group of people who migrated, and it certainly held for the three societies that I studied, were those people who had both the means to leave, but were poor enough that they experienced want on a regular basis.
And so this is where the title of your book, Hungering for America, comes from, I assume.
Absolutely, because America had established a reputation, and well-deserved, as early as the 18th century, as a place of abundance. People in Europe and elsewhere in the world as well knew from a whole range of sources that food in America was cheap, that the working class in America had access to food, to the kind of food that back home or in Europe was in fact limited to the well-off, to the elite, or for the poor, it was something they might have every once in a while on a feast day, but usually in very small amounts. And America was someplace they could have it every day through their own efforts.
So if the streets are not paved with gold, maybe they're paved with bread and meat especially?
Meat in particular is what American streets were paved with.
Yes. Well, there are differences, though, you argue, I think, among these ethnic groups, immigrant groups that you write about. Let's start with the Italians, and what is their food story?
Well, their food story was that the poor, that class of people who migrated, learned through a variety of social practices what good food was. They had a particular relationship with their own elite by which they came to understand the idea of good food. And when they came to America, they could take on those foods as their own on a daily basis. But what's really interesting in the Italian case is that those foods were not defined as, quote, Italian food back home. Back home they were regional, they were town specialties. The idea of Italian was a relatively new concept. When immigrants come to the United States and are able to have access to pasta, to cheese, to olive oil, to meat, to kind of all the good stuff, they come to define it as Italian food, although back home they would have never used that phrase to describe what that food was, either if somebody else was eating it or if they were lucky enough to have a chance to get it themselves. They would have never called it Italian. So food became a powerful vehicle by which immigrants from the hundreds of different towns and regions up and down the Italian peninsula came to define themselves as having become American.
So
having
if we,
become Italian.
Yes, yes, right. If we look at this from the American perspective, are you saying then that the things that we today think of as Italian food in some ways are not Italian, that even they're invented in America?
Much of them were invented in America. They had echoes to foods that existed in, again, some parts of Italy. But the way in which we have come to understand them as Italian, the way they're presented to the American public now as Italian, was very much an American invention.
So, for example, spaghetti and meatballs?
Spaghetti and meatballs is probably the best case. There was a wonderful little memoir I found of an Italian man who was actually quite well off, who came in the 1920s to New York. He was actually an official of the government. And he described walking up and down one of the streets in Little Italy. And that idea even of Little Italy is clearly an American idea. Mm. And he said, I saw these wonderful signs for such things as spaghetti and meatballs and chicken parmesan and broccoli siciliano. And I thought, what wonderful foods. Somebody should send them back to Italy because the people there would like it as well.
Yeah.
And he said, I just thought it was a joke that these places were called Italian restaurants.
Yes, yes. Well, let's try to keep in mind the Italian experience, as you've briefly outlined it here, and move to the Irish, which I think, as you argue, is a very different experience. The Irish, you argue, don't have quite distinctive Irish cuisine in America.
Okay, the Irish are really the opposite for the Italians. They stand at two poles. For the Irish, who also go through the same process, that is, relatively poor people come to a place where they can afford to eat better than they ever had before, food does not show up as part of their ethnic repertoire. It doesn't become a way in which they perform for themselves or for others the idea of Irishness. They certainly use music and dance and politics to build ethnic identity in America, but food is, we might say, off the table.
What about the potato?
Okay, well, the potato could have been that. It could have served that function. They could have developed a whole culture in America celebrating the potato as the essence of Irishness. But the potato was a food that had been imposed upon them by the British. Potato was neither, quote, natural to Ireland, nor was it something that inspired great loyalty, but rather it was a symbol of the domination of the British, of their lands and of their lives. So we have lots of songs, the Ballad of the Rotten Potatoes, the Ballad of the Black Potatoes, but nothing about the potatoes as a positive indicator of who they were and how they wanted to present themselves to their children, to their American-born children, as well as to their American neighbors.
But on St. Patrick's Day, we all Americans eat corned beef and cabbage, for example. Is that invented in America as well?
Absolutely invented in America. And in fact, not only invented in America, but invented so late that I didn't deal with it in my book, because it's really not until the 1930s, which is beyond the scope of this study, that Irish entrepreneurs in America come up with the idea of marketing corned beef and cabbage as distinctively Irish. And they did this because they saw that all the other immigrant groups who were coming to America and the ethnic communities were using food as not only a marker of ethnicity, but as a way to develop a kind of communal economic infrastructure. That is, they saw that Italians were marketing themselves and being able to bring in tourists and make money through Italian food, so they came up with the idea of corned beef and cabbage. Certainly, we know that the Irish in both Ireland and America, if they could afford it in Ireland, but in America also, did consume cabbage, but it was never a symbol of Irishness, and it was never a particularly profound part of their identity. But this becomes very much an invented American tradition.
Yes, yes. Let's move to the third group. You've written about the Italians, the Irish, and thirdly, in Hungering for America, you write about the Eastern European Jewish immigrants. What was food for them. It was so very important for them.
Yes. Well, they come out of a religious world in which food was squarely in the center of the sacred universe. Food was something that could convey sanctity, and it could also convey the opposite. That is, if food was not kosher, if food was in any way threatened, then sanctity was gone. Jews also lived in a world that we have evidence going back hundreds and hundreds of years, in which holy time was squarely associated with good eating, and it was very much the obligation of those Jews who had resources to share with the poor, so that the poor could mark off holy time. So in many of the memoirs and other documents we have about Jewish life in Europe, one of the most sacred obligations was for the well-off to provide the poor with food for Sabbath. Because there was no Sabbath. Without meat, for example, the poor would really be robbed of their ability to mark off that holy time. So that food was sacred, but food was also then part of a class-based communal system of obligations.
And so once Jewish immigrants get to America, what happens then?
Well, what happens is that they have not only are they less dependent on their own well-off to feed them, but America provides them with a place to test out the limits of community or the limits of the tradition. America, a place which they embraced with tremendous enthusiasm. They loved so much about America. America was a place where you could get very easily all sorts of food which was previously forbidden and which they didn't necessarily have access to. And so that food in America for Jews became, in part, it's not the only part of the story, but in part, food became a source of tremendous communal conflict. Families, institutions, divided over what should be kosher, what isn't kosher, who would determine that, and if, in fact, that has to be the standard that the community must follow.
Yes. And yet there isn't this kind of conflict in Italian-American community
over food. No, it's interesting that food for the Italians really emerged as a kind of communal consensus. This is what we have, and what we have is good, and we're really not so interested in eating what other people have to offer.
Yes.
In fact, what I found is that in Italian sources, when Italians did begin to eat the food of other Americans, they, however, sort of co-opted it and we might say Italianized it. And so if they begin to eat steak, they start calling it Italian steak or Italian meatloaf, even though this is not even slightly Italian, but they incorporate it and never view it as someone else's, but find a way to cover it in the kind of cloak of Italian authenticity. For Jews, the idea that something belonged to somebody else and they were getting a chance to have it was actually, for those who wanted to have it, positively good. And so at a very early age, Jewish immigrants and their children begin to become great consumers of Italian food.
Yes.
And calling it Italian food, and they come to love Chinese food.
Right.
Okay, and rather than hiding it, as it were, and trying to call it Jewish, they're positively enthusiastic about the fact that this is Chinese food.
Yes. We're just about out of time. Let me ask, if I can, if you have a favorite food, one that, and you write a lot, we can get a chance to talk about this, about memory and the memory of food. Do you have a favorite food, one you remember?
Oh, from my own childhood? Well, I grew up in an East European Jewish immigrant home, and I would say, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say that there was an item that I have not had in such a long time because it's so unbelievably unhealthy, and it was called Grievenes. And this was, you know, I think any cardiologist listening to this program will be appalled, but it was chicken, it was the chicken fat in which is fried pieces of skin of the chicken and onion and garlic and then kind of mopped up with bread. And it was always in our home right before the Sabbath.
Yes.
We would get a bowl of Grievenes, and bread to mop it up in. And I had such powerful memories of that. And I have a feeling I may never eat it again.
Yes.
I wouldn't make it. It's so unhealthy. Yes. But I can still smell it.
Yes. Well, we all have memories of food. And thank you for sharing your memories and your larger story. I've been speaking with Hasia Diner, author of Hungering for America, Italian, Irish, and Jewish Foodways in the Age of Migration, published by Harvard University Press. Thank you very much, Professor Diner.
My pleasure.
For our site of the week, we continue on the subject, the history of food, and call to your attention a museum entirely devoted to the subject. Talking History's Joey Skidmore tells you all about it.
The Agropolis Museum in Montpellier, France, is a science center that deals with topics such as food, nutrition, and agriculture with an historical approach on a worldwide scale. Either within its walls or virtually, it offers a number of fascinating exhibits, including History of Food and Agriculture, which shows how, from his origin, man has struggled to get food, even if the forms of his quest have changed. Farmers and Farming Over the World looks at the great diversity of farming worldwide and over time. The Banquet of Humanity points out the differences in what we have eaten and how those differences relate to income, resources, and cultural background. And Agrarian Landscapes of the World, which examines how man has cleared forests, changed the course of rivers, maintained pasture lands, and domesticated plants and animals to provide food for his table. And if you can't get to France in the near future, you can always visit the museum's website at www.museum.agropolis.fr.
Thank you, Joey. And if you want more, try the Food Museum at foodmuseum.com. The Food Museum, which recently expanded from its origins as the Potato Museum, offers online information on what we eat, how we eat it, where it came from, how it has evolved, and what its impact has been on culture. Further, in addition to its online exhibits, the folks at the Food Museum make available actual exhibits on a wide range of food-related topics. See what they have to offer at foodmuseum.com.
I'm a hungry end of the day.
Finally, we turn to our commentary of the week, New Words for September 11th. Last month, we marked the first anniversary of the tragic events of 9/11/2001 with a variety of activities. Andrew Shockett offers his thoughts on one of those observations.
To mark the first anniversary of the September 11th attacks, Republican and Democratic politicians read aloud Abraham Lincoln's 1863 Gettysburg Address and Franklin Roosevelt's 1941 Four Freedoms speech. But rereading old speeches didn't honor the fallen of September 11th or provide the inspiration the nation needs to give that tragedy meaning. The Gettysburg Address and the Four Freedoms perfectly evoke the particular circumstances that challenged the United States then, not now, and were inspiring because Lincoln and Roosevelt called on Americans to sacrifice for great goals. Today's leaders must still define the goals of the war on terrorism, and they have yet to ask all Americans to take part in accomplishing its ends. Lincoln spoke at Gettysburg to honor the Union dead after the bloody battle that turned the Civil War in the Union's favor. He redefined the Union effort to establish a new birth of freedom so that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. Lincoln was saying that the best way to honor the Union dead was to purify American democracy by abolishing slavery and to show the Republic's resilience by winning the war. The shocking death of innocents on September 11th was nothing like the massive three-day battle at Gettysburg. The war on terrorism wasn't a civil war, nor does slavery resemble terrorism. Likewise, the circumstances of Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech to Congress on January 6, 1941, bore few similarities to today's. Roosevelt called on Americans to defend freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Freedom of expression referred directly to Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, and freedom of religion to the Nazi persecution of the Jews. Terrible, but not terrorism. Roosevelt's freedom from want meant a healthy peacetime life for all people. How dare today's leaders speak those words when millions of Americans cannot afford health care? And Roosevelt's freedom from fear meant that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor. Perhaps freedom from fear is an argument for invading Iraq, but no one has made it yet. Finally, Lincoln and Roosevelt called on all Americans to contribute. FDR asked Americans to put patriotism ahead of pocketbooks, frankly telling them that a part of the sacrifice means the payment of more money and taxes. That's a far cry from contemporary politicians who consider the selfishness of tax cuts more sacred than the public good. This September 11th was not a time to retreat into a different past nor continue a selfish present. Rather, it was a time to reflect on the unique tragedy of last September 11th, to articulate what a better future would look like, and what all Americans can do to bring it about. Today's leaders can refer to the past, just as Lincoln evoked the Declaration of Independence and Roosevelt referred to Lincoln's new birth of freedom. But they must provide a new vision to show how the ideals of the past can be made to fit today's challenges. A year later, the nation's citizens are willing and eager to undertake grand sacrifices to give meaning to the tragedy of last September 11th. If only the nation's leaders ask in their own words and make their own history.
You've been listening to Andrew Schockett, Professor of History at Bowling Green State University. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. And until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.